Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, tomorrow will be an historic day in Detroit, and really for Michigan. That's when a federal judge decides whether the city is eligible for Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection. On today's show, we look at the different ways Judge Stephen Rhodes could rule. And then, what is the future of newspapers? As newsrooms get smaller and more people hop online for information, will the industry be able to reinvent itself to keep up with the times? We'll have that story later this hour. But first, we could soon see a vote in the state legislature, a vote that will be closely watched by those on either side of the abortion issue. The vote would be on a citizen-initiated bill that could end abortion coverage as a standard feature in health insurance policies. Right to Life of Michigan turned in more than 315,000 signatures to get this bill before the legislature. And earlier today, the Board of State Canvassers certified this petition, and it now goes to the state legislature. MLive reporter Jonathan Osting joins us now. Jonathan, we first talked about this bill last month here on Stateside, but give us a recap. Exactly what would this bill do?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, it would prohibit insurance policies from offering abortion coverage as a standard option. Now, women could still choose to purchase an additional rider for abortion coverage, and employers could choose to offer it. But if they did so, they would have to alert all employees of that policy decision. It's sort of related to the Affordable Care Act, but it would actually apply to insurance policies sold in the state, whether they be through an Affordable Care Act exchange or whether you just, call up an insurance provider and try and buy one in the private marketplace.
So a woman would have to buy a separate rider to cover an abortion, and she'd have to do this before she ever knew whether or not she'd need an abortion, never after getting pregnant, right?
Yeah, that is, one of the controversial aspects of this. It also does not include exceptions for cases of rape or incest. So critics would point out that, a woman cannot plan ahead for a rape and would probably appreciate having coverage if that were the case.
Now, do we have any idea what this kind of rider might cost?
I haven't actually been able to peg that down. Under the Affordable Care Act, states can opt out. However, that law reinforced existing policies that federal dollars can't actually be used for abortion. So it's unclear what effect that'll actually have. Theoretically, these insurers could offer a free rider if they wanted to, since no part of a subsidized policy is supposed to be used for abortion coverage in the first place. However, there's no rules on that, and I doubt there's going to be a lot of free offers.
So how likely now that the state Board of State Canvassers has certified these signatures, the petition is good, it moves on to the legislature, how likely do you think it'll be that the legislature will address this bill before breaking off for the holidays?
Well, Right to Life is certainly very confident. Right to Life organized the petition drive, and they point out, rightly so, that the legislature approved a similar law last year before it was vetoed by the governor. And they say that also a majority of lawmakers signed the petitions this time around, including Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville. So they have expressed a whole lot of confidence that lawmakers will take it up. However, it is controversial. I think, Republican leadership knows that and wants to avoid some of the public protests that happened last year regarding a different abortion-related bill. But certainly they're aware of the political implications of 2014. So there is some hesitance to take it up immediately. But if they do, I anticipate it's going to be in the next 2 weeks here so they can get it done before the end of the year.
Let's talk a little more about this citizens' initiative, because the question will have to be asked, how is it that 315,000 signatures on a petition can make policy happen for some 9.9 million people who live in Michigan?
Certainly. It's an interesting process. They have to collect a higher number of signatures than you would for a referendum or another type of ballot proposal. However, I think a lot of people, when they are signing their name to something, sort of assume that it is for a ballot proposal. But that's not the case with a citizens' initiative. The legislature now has 40 days to decide whether they want to act or not. They have several options. They can approve the bill as is. They can propose an alternative, in which case the bill and their proposal would both go to the ballot, or they can do nothing, which would send the proposal to the ballot. And opponents of this legislation point out, as you mentioned, that you know, roughly 300,000 signatures represents only a fraction of Michigan voters, and they're saying, let it go to the ballot, let the voters decide. Of course, polling shows that it probably wouldn't pass, so you know, that they would favor that outcome.
And then we know a year ago Governor Snyder vetoed a similar bill, and at the time he said it went too far because it treated abortions that involved rape or incest or the health of the mother as elective procedures. But if the legislature passes this, it is veto-proof, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. The citizen-initiated process is a means to bypass a uncooperative governor. And Right to Life has been very upfront that they were surprised that the governor vetoed the bill, and that they saw this as the most streamlined way to go around that veto. So it does set up an interesting dynamic between the Republican-led legislature and a Republican-led governor, in which case, if the legislature does approve it, they would, in fact, be approving this end round as well.
Jonathan Osting of MLive, thank you so much for the update, Jonathan.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments this morning in a case that pits the state of Michigan against an Upper Peninsula Indian tribe. This case revolves around the tribe's plan to open an off-reservation casino. Rick Pluta is the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, and he joins us now from D.C. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Cindy.
So you were at the Supreme Court today following this case between the state of Michigan and the Bay Mills Indian community. What is the issue here?
The Bay Mills tribe decided that they wanted to basically branch out further than the eastern Upper Peninsula and its sparse customer base. And so they opened up a casino off its reservation, 100 miles away, and it's kind of a test case that if they could open a casino in Vanderbilt, an off-reservation casino, they think that they could open them up in, you know, maybe a couple of other places as well. And there are some other tribal casino projects being proposed around the state as well. Most notably, the Sault Ste. Marie tribe would like to open one up in Lansing. And so that's kind of what's at play here, although unlike the Lansing case, Michigan said, you can't do that, went to federal court seeking an injunction to shut down the casino, and it has played out through the courts, and now it's before the United States Supreme Court on this singular question of whether states like Michigan can sue an Indian tribe for something that's going on off the reservation.
So what did you hear at today's arguments?
Well, the court, the justices of the court seemed really interested, first of all, in why the state felt like it had to go to court and challenge the tribes, what's called its sovereign immunity, that because tribes are government, that they enjoy some immunity from certain types of lawsuits. And what the tribe is saying is that on off-reservation activities, this still applies to them. The court wanted to know why the state of Michigan didn't go to arbitration and why, if this is against Michigan's gaming laws, the state didn't just go in and use its police power to shut it down.
And what did they say?
That the state's response was that there are a lot of options out there, but they thought this one was the cleanest one and the most respectful to tribal sovereignty, which is sort of interesting that you know, the state is arguing that it was respecting tribal sovereignty by challenging it. But they said that really sending in the state police to shut down a casino, to arrest maybe its customers, the people who work there, even tribal leaders, would be disrespectful to the tribes, disrespectful to tribal sovereignty, and the sort of confrontation that we want to avoid and really why civil actions in courts exist.
And what arguments did we hear from the Bay Mills side?
Well, what the Bay Mills tribe said was that there are plenty of other ways to resolve this particular dispute if the state would only choose to do it. But most specifically on the legal question, that these lawsuits can't be allowed unless Congress passes a law abrogating tribal immunity in a case like this, or if the tribe simply gives it up, passes a rule saying we agreed that we can be sued on questions like this. The tribe hasn't done it. Congress hasn't done it, and if Congress hasn't done it, then it's not the place of the United States Supreme Court to second-guess Congress. That's the argument that they made.
And, Rick, this case really is getting a lot of attention nationwide?
Yes. Well, there's a lot at stake for states that want to be able to enforce their laws by going to federal court to get an injunction, and they say that's not just gaming laws. But we could be talking about tribal laws, underage drinking laws, health and safety laws, things like that, you know, as well, even things like prostitution laws. And what the tribes say is that there are still plenty of avenues to resolve these disputes, but they say their concern is that their sovereign immunity for all kinds of off-reservation enterprises is at stake, because really the only way the tribes can derive revenue is from these businesses. And there's not a lot of business on the reservation, so a lot of times they have to go off reservation, and the way that they protect their trust funds and the money that they use for police and fire, schools, other governmental functions, basically comes from having that revenue protected by sovereign immunity.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, joining us from D.C., where he is covering today's arguments in front of the Supreme Court in the case of Michigan versus Bay Mills Indian Community. Rick, thank you so much.
My pleasure, and the statue of John Marshall says hello.
Well, tell him hello back. A Michigan duo from Traverse City is getting a lot of praise for their indie rock music. We'll talk with The Accidentals about their newest album, Bittersweet. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tomorrow will be one for the history books, not just here in Michigan, but across the nation. Tuesday morning is when federal bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes will rule whether or not Detroit is eligible for bankruptcy protection. So let's look at what might happen tomorrow morning as we're joined by someone who covered the bankruptcy trial, Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So let us start, if we can, with what all the experts tell us to expect. What happens if Judge Rhodes rules that Detroit is indeed eligible for Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection? Then what?
Well, what happens is the emergency manager in Detroit, Kevin Orr, is empowered even more further than he is now to really restructure and reshape what City Hall and city government of Detroit looks like. And that that power could extend to the ability to try to cut pensions. It could extend to the ability to sell art, sell other assets, to pay debts. And it essentially gives him this ability to put together a plan of adjustment, is what it's called, a debt-cutting plan that reorganizes the city of Detroit, tries to pare down at least $10 to $11 billion of an $18 billion deficit and present it to creditors where there will be a vote to whether to accept it, although it's kind of an interesting form of democracy, bankruptcy court. If you can get some impaired creditors to go along, people who are taking a haircut, to accept your deal, you can use them to what they call cram down the deal on everybody else. So it's a huge deal to get eligibility in bankruptcy. This will make Detroit firmly the largest city ever to be granted bankruptcy protection from its creditors.
So it certainly seems that the impact would be really felt by the stakeholders, the creditors, the employee unions, the city pensioners. Would it feel any different on the street for citizens?
Probably not, but that's part of what they're trying to work towards in bankruptcy is essentially freeing up more money for improving services, for fixing the lights, for fixing the 56 or lowering the 56 minute response time for police for non-emergency calls. That kind of improvement, we've all seen the stories of the fire tanks that leak water, but the city is trying to use bankruptcy to pare down on these pensions and health care and legacy costs, and also all this general debt the city has racked up, because the city essentially has been masking over deficits year by year by just borrowing more money. And so that's some of the debt that the city is trying to shed here in bankruptcy.
So all that string and scotch tape, as they tried to mask it over, has fallen off. But there is a chance Detroit could be ruled ineligible for Chapter 9. Then what?
Well, then most experts say it'll be literally financial and legal chaos in the city. There is a number of lawsuits that were filed just before the bankruptcy in Ingham County Court, trying to stop the filing by getting a judge to rule that the filing itself would violate the constitutional protection of pensions. And so there will probably, those lawsuits would get revised because in bankruptcy, all lawsuits are essentially frozen. So if the judge kicks them out of bankruptcy, there will be an immediate thaw of that of those frozen lawsuits and other law. There's 500 some odd cases that were pending against the city. There will all be other claims to try to collect debts by other creditors, because essentially the city has defaulted. It did default in on its pension payments, debt payments, back in June. Mm-hmm. Hasn't made a lot of other bills and pay. They've been essentially, the city's been hoarding cash while it's been in this timeout period, you might say, since they filed for bankruptcy on July 18th. So if the city is not granted eligibility, there could be just be an untold number of legal problems for the city, and they'll have to go back to the drawing board. And they've been pretty frank that they don't really have a plan B.
So they don't have a plan B, but all right, if the judge kicked it back and said, no, it's not eligible, would Kevin Orr be able to file for bankruptcy again, or does that take that possibility off the table?
He would be if there's not some state lawsuit that stops the governor from authorizing a bankruptcy filing, because under our emergency manager law, that you have to have the governor's approval. And if there was some type of an injunction against the governor, that could possibly cause harm to it. And the judge has been pushing all sides all along this whole case since they filed in July to try to mediate. And there's a lot of these, been numerous closed door mediation sessions that the public is not privy to, that have been going on. They're still going on. They're scheduled into next month. And really, if this, all signs have pointed that the judge is probably going to find this city eligible, but he has also shown signs that he has been a little perturbed by the way Kevin Orr and the city's legal team kind of went about this. And clearly, just based on the lawsuits that were being filed back in July, the city essentially ran to bankruptcy court to try to escape those legal injunctions of state judges.
Because if I recall, literally minutes before that, Ingham County judge was going to issue a restraining order blocking the governor from authorizing the filing, the city went ahead and did it. It was really down to minutes, wasn't it?
That's right. I was actually in Ingham County Court in Judge Rosemary Aquilina's courtroom, and we were sitting around waiting for the judge to come out. And what the real backstory was, they were waiting for the attorney general's representative to show up in court, and he kind of moseyed in a few minutes after four, and as he was apparently going through security, the city was filing for bankruptcy in federal court in Detroit. So
it was
literally a 5 minute interval, because that judge came out and said that she was prepared to issue the injunction and block the filing. So some of that will go back into play if this doesn't happen, and it's really hard. It'll be less orderly, to say the least, than how things have been progressing in the city of Detroit since then. And like I said, most people expect the judge to rule on this. And a lot of people, the one thing to watch for is whether he takes up the issue of pensions, about whether he rules that the pensions cannot be impaired in the debt-cutting process. Some people think he may not rule on that, because the city and the state argued throughout the trial that just being eligible for bankruptcy doesn't necessarily cut a pension. We have to present a plan that says we do want to cut the pensions. But there's a lot of things that are going to take place here in the next month, because Kevin Orr wants to file this plan by the end of the month, this debt cutting plan. So there, some people have said to me, if you want to get a deal, now is the time to get in line.
So, Chad, based on what you saw and what you heard as you covered the bankruptcy trial, what do you expect to happen tomorrow morning?
I would expect that the judge would rule in favor of the city and grant it eligibility, and not touch the pension issue at this point. I also would expect that this judge, while he has been sympathetic to the city of Detroit and the plight of Detroiters in general, the fact that they just don't have, you know, functioning government and municipality, he also may continue to really kind of chide the emergency manager and the city's legal team for their sort of rushed and sometimes sloppy approach to this. There's one argument about whether good faith negotiations were made, and then there's a way to essentially say, well, it was impractical, and it does seem the judge might cite on the argument that it was impractical to negotiate with 100,000 people.
Looking ahead to tomorrow's historic ruling from federal bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes. We've been speaking with Chad Livengood, reporter with the Detroit News. Always a pleasure, Chad. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We sat beneath the stars at a fire and played our new guitars, and I wondered how long this was gonna last. Because picture perfect memories just come with all those tougher things, and pain's the best reminder of our past.
The Accidentals are Katie Larson and Savannah Beist, who met at the Interlochen Arts Academy. They are 18 years old, and they're joining us from Traverse City. You guys both come from musical families with an incredibly similar background. Katie, your dad is a pianist at Interlochen?
Yes. That's actually the reason why I'm living in Michigan. He got a job offer to be a collaborative pianist. And so that's kind of how I got introduced to music, kind of on the classical side. But yeah, both my parents are very supportive of music.
And what about your mom?
My mom studied voice. When she met my dad, they actually did duets. Like, he'd play piano and she'd sing like Broadway songs or like classic hits. And right now she also works at Interlochen in the program office. So they're both here with me at school.
And Savannah Beist, you're from Nashville, and your dad played piano at the Grand Ole Opry?
Oh, yeah. Those are the days.
Not many of us. I want you to understand, there are very few of us who can go, yeah, those are the days of the Grand Ole Opry. So this is truly in your blood.
Yeah, you could say that. My dad is really my hero, and so is my mom. They played in the band together for about 3 years before they got married and had me. And then we moved from Nashville when I was five. And I just think that it's been a really great experience having a family with a lot of music behind it, because otherwise I probably wouldn't nearly be into as much music.
As we listen to your music, it truly has a wise beyond their years feel and sound. Not only to the way you play your instruments, but to your lyrics. And had you both been writing, or was that something that came out of becoming a duo?
Well, this is Katie. I was writing a little while before I met Savannah, kind of like closet singer-songwriter, just kind of doing it for fun. But I was way too afraid to show anyone my songs at all. Mm-hmm. Like, I could never sing in public at all. And I met Savannah, and we kind of realized we needed original material. And Savannah, I mean, you can talk about your writing.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't writing at all, really, any songs before I met Katie. I just thought that was a thing that my parents did for our family band. So I was like, they can be the writers, and I'll just sing harmony and play violin. But when I met Katie, I saw that she was writing a bunch of crazy songs, and I was like, you know, I could probably do that. Like, if I really sat down and, you know, thought about it, I could probably write a song. Anybody could. So then I started writing.
The other thing is you really got, you wrote stories beforehand.
Oh, yeah. I didn't write songs.
So I think that helped out.
So the writing was there. And then somehow it sounds like the joining together gave you the oomph you felt you needed to put it out there. You know, Katie said you were way too afraid to show that stuff to the world. And then you met Savannah, and Katie's unlocked something in you. So you really are a wonderful duo. And here you are. You're already out with your second album with Bittersweet, and the first one was received well, and you really got a chance to work with some pretty veteran names. Who worked with you on Bittersweet?
We went to Nashville and worked with a producer named Rob Feaster, and he works at Quad Studios. And we also went to Bloomington and worked with Paul Mahern of White Arc Studios.
That's in Indiana.
So here you are, 18. You've got two albums out. You have been playing all around Northern Michigan, and then you composed an original score for an indie film. Savannah, tell us about that.
Yeah, actually, we have worked on two movies now. We composed original scores for a movie called One Simple Question, and that's going to be out soon. And then we also, some of our songs off of our brand new album, Bittersweet, have been included on a new film called Please Wait to Be Seated. And we've already seen these clips, and we're really excited to, have the public receive that. It's just going to be really cool. And that's actually something that I'm rather passionate about, is film scoring and along those lines of things. So that's just really exciting.
We're going to take a listen to a little more of the song that we opened up with called The Silence. Before we do, Savannah, tell us about that song. That's yours, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the first track off our new CD. And I wrote that one. It was towards the end of the year. I was about to transfer into Interlochen Arts Academy, and I was really scared that I wasn't going to have any of my old friends anymore because I'd be spending most of my time at a new school. And we were all watching this meteor shower with my old friends. We were all watching this meteor shower, and I was like, how long is this going to last? And then I thought, it doesn't matter how long it's going to last. I'm here, and I can just appreciate these moments that I have now.
We walked in a haunted place with tattered walls and empty space and a musty smell that drenched the nighttime air. Neither of us said a word and we waited till we heard the birds and realized not once had we ever been scared. So many theories wrong and soon disproved. And so many ideas lost among the few.
I'm speaking with Katie Larson and Savannah Beist, a progressive folk duo based in Traverse City. They call themselves the Accidentals. They met in school. They've gone through Interlochen together. And I'm wondering, Katie Larson, who's your role model in the musical world?
Oh, we both have a lot of role models.
You can name more than one.
Well, there are different kinds of role models, I think. Living in Traverse City, we are definitely surrounded by inspirational artists. There's a huge local music scene, and we have been able to work with and be mentored by like Blake Elliott and like, Billy Strings and Don Julin and some other really great names in the local scene, but also national music. We're both fans of Andrew Bird, who's a violinist.
Major fans of Andrew Bird.
Yeah, definitely indie artists who kind of are unique in what they do and stay true to themselves and are just do cool stuff.
Are you hoping to get picked up by a major label, or is that feel of being indie right for you where you're at right now?
We're looking at some different options right now, but we're trying to be very open to what we are offered. We just want to keep an open mind about it all, and we want, to be surrounded by people who we can trust and who are mentoring us on how to function in the music business, because it's a big scheme of, it's just a very large foreign world to us, and we're looking right now to surround ourselves with people who care about us and who are going to help us decide what to do next with our career.
So, Katie, how do you balance all of your schoolwork and your songwriting and performing? How do you make that all work?
It takes a lot of work to make sure everything's balanced. It helps to have supportive friends and supportive families. I'm working to finish my senior year, and Savannah's at college. We're applying to some schools next year. We'd like to do some more with film scoring and a lot more touring. We're actually hoping to tour in Europe next summer and see where it goes from there.
Katie Larson and Savannah Beist, the Accidentals. Thank you so much, girls, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we've put a link to some of the Accidental songs on our website at michiganradio.org. Just click on the stateside link.
Once in a cold March, my childhood friend took my hand and dragged me to the driveways and we're in the
up next, the future of newspapers. How will people stay informed when newspapers and staffs are shrinking? Can they survive? You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
My ghosts never fail.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Newspapers just aren't what they used to be. Newsrooms are smaller, and big stories are being missed. For example, the Flint Journal was forced to apologize recently for not telling voters that a city council candidate was also a convicted murderer until a day after he won election. So how will people stay informed when newspapers and their staffs are shrinking? Joining us to discuss the state of the newspaper industry is James O'Shea. He's the Howard Marsh Professor of Journalism at the University of Michigan. His book is Deal from Hell. It looks at the struggles of the newspaper business. James is also the former editor of the Los Angeles Times. And joining us is Mike McLaren, the executive director of the Michigan Press Association. Now, Mike, you do not believe newspapers are dying. Why is that?
Well, I guess I would answer that question with a question. Do you know what Sony Corporation's first product was?
I don't.
Many people think it was either the Betamax or a Walkman or something like that. Actually, it was a rice cooker.
Oh, well.
It was a rice cooker. And yet, Sony Corporation clearly is known for many different products now than it was when it was making rice cookers right in post-World War II Japan. So it goes with the newspaper business. I'm not suggesting we're going to get into the rice cooking business, but Sony Corporation reinvented themselves. They evolved into becoming, one would argue, probably one of the top consumer electronics companies in the world. Newspapers are going to continue to evolve as well. They will still be in the news business. They might not be in the news on paper, newspaper business forever and ever, but they are in the midst of an evolving process, and I think that's something to bear in mind. Any healthy company or industry that is not content with focusing on the here and now and is rather looking at how they're going to evolve to meet consumer needs and tastes and preferences into the future is a pretty critical element for their success.
James O'Shea, you were the editor of the Los Angeles Times. You are now teaching future journalists at the University of Michigan. We see headlines from all around the country about newspapers having to fold, having to gut the newsroom staff. Can you give us an understanding of what is really at the heart of the economic realities facing newspapers?
Yeah, it's a 50% decline in their main source of revenue, which was advertising. It happened in two phases, one in the 90s, in the late 90s and early 2000s, when they lost their classified advertising franchise to organizations like Craigslist, which began offering advertisements for free, whereas the newspapers used to charge from them. It was a lucrative source of income for them. And then secondly, as the Internet has developed, the display advertising or the kinds of ads that you see throughout the front sections of newspapers are going away, and they're migrating to all sorts of different kinds of media, including social media and the Internet and Google and all of these other people who are coming into the market and basically and offering, frankly, a better way for a lot of these firms to advertise. And so, you know, it used to be you'd charge $2, let's say, for a newspaper, and you were depending on advertising to provide, you know, it cost you. Let's go back a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You're delivering something to somebody's door for $2, say, and it's costing you $4 to get it there.
Okay.
When you consider the driver, the print, the paper, the ink, the reporters, everything. And so what you were doing is, you know, you were hoping that you'd get the $2 for delivering it there, and then you'd get $2 more in advertising, which would cover your cost and actually a little more and make it profitable. So when that $2 from advertising starts going away, you become either marginally profitable or unprofitable, and that's what's really going on. The industry is trying to figure out, is there some other source of revenue that they can adapt so that they can make up for that loss of ad revenue? And so some of them are trying paywalls, and some of them are raising their prices. The hard part is a lot of papers, particularly the metropolitan dailies in the larger cities, are in such a, they're really in a life and death struggle, I think, and they spend so much of their time trying to stay alive and keep the doors open. They aren't really, they don't have the time to sit down and really come up with strategies for alternate sources of revenue, which is really what's needed. And when they can't come up with another source of revenue, they start cutting. And then you get into a kind of a vicious circle. You cut your, you cut the size of the paper, you cut the amount of news in it, you cut their staff, and you don't have as many reporters or photographers. And then, you know, your advertisers that are already kind of going away start looking and saying, well, we're not too happy with what's going on here. Mm. We're going to take our ad dollars elsewhere. And so in response to that, they cut again. And you get into this cycle of cutting and cutting that could, that's really destructive. And so I think the situation probably is different in smaller community papers than it is in metropolitan dailies, but all papers are facing this dramatic shift in their revenue sources, and that's what's causing the problem.
I would agree, and I would say that, to your point, one of my concerns is with the smaller market papers, while you're right, they're not dealing with this in such stark instances right now, I'm worried about them for the future because they're not having to face some real critical decisions and looking at new ways of reaching their audience in ways and formats that they want to be reached. While recent research that just came out from Newspaper Association of America says that 70% of adults read a newspaper each week in print or online. That's a pretty strong audience. And other media, traditional media, if I may, TV, cable, radio, with some exceptions, NPR being one of them, they're losing audience dramatically as well, and yet they care not to report on it. Sadly, that's one of the problems with my industry newspapers is they're quick to seize on data that says newspaper print circulation has fallen when really their audience is getting larger. Mobile users in particular have boosted newspapers' online audience by 50%. One of the things that's not necessarily discussed too often is how newspaper-specific information, whether it's produced by the LA Times or Detroit News and Free Press or Ann Arbor News, is being retweeted or Facebooked or referenced on other social media. That's a pretty large audience as well. But to your point, clearly the print franchise took a tremendous hit when Craigslist came around. That was the that was a painful wake-up call for the industry, and it's still trying to reinvent itself along the way.
From a journalistic perspective, my concern is this. You know, if you look around the country today and you say, okay, who's really covering, who's manning the courthouses, mm-hmm. who's going in the state houses, who's manning police beats and city halls? Virtually all of them are being staffed by newspapers. And it's kind of what I call the journalistic infrastructure. That's the people that actually go out and report on government and the kinds of things, the kind of information that people need to make good decisions about how they're governed. But as the newspapers are cutting back, way, way back, and there was a study done in Baltimore, Maryland, a couple of years ago, by a journalistic organization called the Project for Excellence in Journalism. And they actually isolated a lot of stories, and they said, okay, where did this story come from? Who actually did the reporting on this story? And 80% of the reporting that came out of the city of Baltimore over a six-week period were done mainly by newspapers. Mm-hmm. But the Baltimore Sun, which is the main newspaper there, has cut its staff by at least 50% over that same period of time. So the question becomes, you know, the journalistic infrastructure is crumbling. And who's going to do that reporting when all of a sudden the newspaper says, you know, I can't afford it anymore. It's over. Who's going to do that? How are people going to get that information? That's a critical question because that goes right to the heart of what our country is and what a democracy is. And a democracy is founded on the idea that if people have the right information, they'll make the smartest decisions. But if they don't have that information, or in the alternative, if the information they're getting is merely propaganda or something put out by somebody and then picked up by newspapers who just need the content, you're looking at a fundamental shift in the way we live. And I think that's a real problem.
That was James O'Shea speaking. He is the Howard March Professor of Journalism at the University of Michigan, former editor of the Los Angeles Times, and his book Deal from Hell looks at the struggles of the newspaper business. And he's joined by Mike McLaren, who's executive director of the Michigan Press Association. I have to wonder, we were talking about the kinds of draconian steps that have had to happen in newsrooms and in newspapers across the country to make up for this loss in revenue. Certainly here in Southeast Michigan, readers of the Detroit Free Press and Detroit News had their home delivery cut to just Thursday, Friday, and Sunday as part of all of this. And I'm wondering, have readers moved to the online editions, or worse for newspapers, have they just learned to live without their daily paper?
Well, they are increasingly using the digital products, and I think the News and Free Press was bold and smart in how they executed this. They were really the first enterprise in the country that stopped everyday delivery, home delivery, and it was a risk. And David Hunke, the publisher at the time, I think, put a lot of thought into it. That increasingly people are using digital products, the News and Free Press in particular, and yet anybody can get those print products delivered to their home if they make special arrangements with the News and Free Press. But you're seeing that increasingly in other municipalities as well across the country. So I think we're not done with that, that you're going to see more and more people doing that as people get more comfortable with digital products and the devices that you can use to read them, in particular cell phones or smartphones.
And James, do you see younger people not having a problem with that? Because I have to say, I think I speak for most of the baby boomer readers who say, I prefer my paper in my hand. It doesn't feel the same flipping through your iPad. But does that not bother the future readers, the young people?
I think young people read it differently. I actually think there's some information they like in print. So I agree with Mike. I think that the industry is all together. The daily newspaper is a doomed institution in terms of delivering a print product to somebody's doorstep every day. It's uneconomical. You can't do it. You're losing money every time you do it. And what in most papers, you know, like I think the Free Press is now Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, or Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday. Those are probably their profitable days. Most newspapers have days where they're profitable and days when they're not. And they always stuck to the 7 days because it was a daily newspaper and it always was going to come out. But what they've done, I think what he did was very smart, because he said, okay, I'm going to cut out the days that are unprofitable so I don't have to lay off journalists, so I can actually put content in the paper that has some value and that people will pay for. So I think that was a smart move. I think you're going to see it all over the country. And I think younger people, they sort of like a Sunday paper where they can sit down when they have the time and go through it. And so they don't really have an objection to the paper. So I think they do have, you know, having it come to their house every day when they can get it on their iPad or their cell phone, and the immediacy of that information. So if you're looking at news and things that are happening, I think they prefer that on a cell phone or on an iPad where you can get it right away. But if it's something that you want to sit down and read and think about, I think they still prefer print. And it's interesting with students. A lot of times you'll say to them, if you're going to use a book in class and it's a textbook, they'll want to go to the bookstore and buy the hardcover or softcover book. But if you're just going to do excerpts out of a book and they aren't going to use it and it's not going to be something that they'll have to refer back to time and again, they'll just go ahead and get an e-book. So I think there's a distinction. It's not completely so black and white as that young people don't like print. I think they like print, but it depends on how they're going to use it.
To your point, to follow up on it, I think, frankly, the term daily or weekly newspaper is becoming an anachronism, because most of those newspapers have websites or digital services that they're offering. And you've got weekly or traditionally weekly papers that are updating their websites every day with late breaking news or local news flashes. And so,
and now
really,
video, too, I'm noticing
Good heavens, the Free Press has won several Emmys in
the last
few years.
Yes, for their video work. So it's, again, pushing the envelope and looking beyond. What do you each say to the young people who want to be journalists? James, you're working with these future reporters and journalists. What does their future hold? And are there new opportunities that, say, the web offers them that didn't exist for either of you when you began your careers?
Well, you know, that's one thing I do talk about. And I remind them that, you know, when I got into journalism, those many years ago, it wasn't high paying. You didn't make a lot. No, you didn't get into journalism to make money. You got into journalism because you really wanted to be a journalist and provide people with information. And the difference is that I had a fairly clear path on where I had to go. I knew I should go to a small paper, get some experience, and work my way up to a larger paper. They don't have that clear of a path. But when I got into the newspaper business, you had to be a a millionaire several times over to own a newspaper. He had to buy the plant, he had to hire the printers, you had to buy trucks and gas and all of that. Today, I myself, in 2009, started a news organization in Chicago. We had no money. It was just a bunch of journalists, and we got operating out of an office over an Einstein bagel shop. And we basically put together a news organization, and for 2.5 years, we supplied Chicago content to the New York Times, the best paper in the country, in the world maybe. And so, you know, I say to them, well, you don't have that certainty that I have. You have opportunities that I couldn't have had. I mean, I just couldn't start a newspaper when I got out of journalism school. But today, someone coming out of journalism school can actually start a news organization and thrive with it. And you have an opportunity for more freedom of expression. And I think these online news organizations, they're more creative in their approach to covering things and covering the news. So I do think there are opportunities, and I think in some cases they can be exciting.
To your point, as far as being able, you know, what the future holds for journalism, I would say to anybody, learn to tell stories in new and compelling ways. Yeah. You're no longer limited to simply ink on paper format. That you can, if you learn to shoot video, if you know XML or HTML web design, that can only help you reach audiences with compelling stories that are going to make a difference in their lives. Whether it's Kwame Kilpatrick's Fall from Grace in Detroit, or how the local water authority was delivering tainted water to residents in the community, and that caused a cancer scare. There's stories out there day in and day out that students can cover in new and compelling, innovative ways, and there will be an audience for that on a variety of platforms. And I think that's something that a lot of journalism schools have recognized and are reconfiguring their coursework to instill those skills in students.
We'll have to leave it there. That was Mike McLaren, who's the executive director of the Michigan Press Association, and he was joined by James O'Shea, who's professor of journalism at the University of Michigan, also the former editor of the Los Angeles Times, and his book, Deal from Hell, looks at the struggles of the newspaper business. It was really good having a conversation with both of you. I hope we can do it again.
Okay,
thank you.
So we are wondering, other than the radio, where do you get your news? The newspaper, TV, internet, or all of the above? Let us know. You can find us on Twitter at Stateside Radio. We're on Facebook, Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and of course the Stateside link at michiganradio.org. We always want to hear from you. Stateside Today was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaugh, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.